What we're going to find as we begin our look into Isaiah chapter 51, if nothing else, the prophet urges the people to pay careful attention. I want you to notice in these verses through the middle of chapter 52, essentially, at least through verse 12 of chapter 52, the number of times in one way or another in which God calls upon the people, the prophet calls upon the people to get it, not just hear it with their ears, but to get what he's been trying to say to them all along. For example, chapter 51, verse 1, listen to me. We've already noted that this idea of listening carries with it the idea of active participation, not just a hearing, but an understanding and a doing. So he's continuing that line of thought here in chapter 51. Verse 1, listen to me. Verse 2, look to me. Look, you need to look to this. You need to pay attention. Verse 4, give attention. Verse 7, listen to me again. Verse 9, awake, awake. Verse 17, wake yourself. Wake yourself. Verse 21, therefore hear this. And then we get into chapter 52, and it's awake, awake again. And it's shake yourself. If you recall, we mentioned that this servant who came speaking was going to call the people of God to participate. We're into that participatory pattern here, or words, where the people now are expected to respond to what God has called them to do. And he's saying all of this to this dejected people, this people carried away into captivity, or who will be carried away into captivity, not because Babylon's just the neighborhood bully. God could have dealt with the neighborhood bully if that were the case. If Babylon were just flexing its muscles and had no right to do what it did, God would have dealt with them. But God used that might of Babylon to punish his people. Their captivity, their problem was not Babylon, it was their own sinfulness and their own inability or unwillingness to deal with that sinfulness that caused them to be carried away into captivity. But God has made that abundantly clear, and now he turns his attention to comfort. That's what beginning in verse 3 of chapter 51 talks about. For the Lord comforts. Look at verse 3 of chapter 51. For the Lord comforts Zion. He comforts all her waste places and makes her wilderness like Eden. I wonder how often we felt that we were just in a dry and desert land. I wonder how often we felt like we were just in a wasteland somewhere, whether physical or spiritual or whatever the case might be. That's certainly going to be Zion's eventual circumstance. The city is going to lay waste because Babylon has come. It has ruined its walls. It has burned down its temple. It's carried away everything of value and worth, including the people. And so there sets the city of God, the city of David, in ruins, the people in captivity. But God says, I'm going to comfort your waste places. I'm going to make your wilderness different. Not only am I going to make it different, notice what he compares it to. He doesn't compare it to its former glory under Solomon. He doesn't compare it to its former glory under David. I'm going to make your wilderness like Eden. When we think of the Garden of Eden, what do we think of? What do we call the Garden of Eden? What's the one word term that we would most frequently use with the Garden of Eden? Any of you gentlemen want to throw out a word? Paradise. I'm going to make your wilderness a paradise. I'm going to make it an Eden. Her desert like the garden of the Lord. Not like Babylon's hanging gardens, which were one of the eight wonders of the world. I'm going to make it like the garden of the Lord. What's going to be found there? It's no longer going to be sorrow. It's no longer going to be crying. It's no longer going to be oppression or imprisonment or whatever the case might have been under Babylon's cruel hand. It's going to be a place of joy and gladness. Joy and gladness are going to be found in Zion. Thanksgiving and the voice of a song. I wonder if a captive people reading again these words of the prophet fully appreciated them. I would venture to guess that the likes of a Daniel did, the likes of a Nehemiah and an Ezra, Zerubbabel certainly would have. Those who were going to make that long trek back from Babylon to Jerusalem had to have some sense of the value and the worth of these words to make that trip back from Babylon. It wasn't a walk in the park that they were going to embark on to go back and to rebuild the city of God, the city of David, to rebuild those walls and to rebuild that temple. It was not going to be easy, but I believe they understood at least to some degree the value and the worth of what the Lord is promising them and the comfort that would be found in their return and in their rebuilding. Their waste places no longer being barren and dry, but there being there a garden of the Lord, a paradise, a garden of Eden, and He comforts her waste places. Look at verse 4. Give attention to me, my people. Give ear to me, my nation. I didn't even include that in the list, the give ear to me. Pay attention, give ear to me, for a law will go out from me, and I will set my justice for a light to the peoples. In the pursuit of righteousness, verse 1 talks about that. After he says, listen to me, he's talking to people who are going to make the decision to pursue righteousness. So here's this idea of participation. As he speaks to his people, as he calls his people, and as he tells them what he's going to do for them, he says your response has to be to pursue righteousness, to participate in this righteousness. And now we get to verse 4, and we see that in the pursuit of righteousness, the justice and law of God are vital. It's not our justice and our law that's important. It's the law and the justice of Yahweh Himself. The law goes out from Him, and He sets justice as a standard. He sets up His justice as that beacon of light that's going to benefit and comfort His people. We sometimes look at things and as to whether they're fair or unfair. That's not just. We need to try and see justice through the eyes of the Holy One of Israel. We need to see that justice that flows from the throne of God as a light that directs us and that truly brings us the comfort that we long for. It's going to come from Him and it's going to benefit His people who pursue Him, who participate in all of this, in this process. Righteousness, salvation, and justice. All of these things are promised. All of these things are urged upon the people of God, and the result is hope and patience. But it's only when we get it. It's only when they get it. Do you know why on the day of Pentecost, why so many people, so many Jews came from so many places? Have you ever given that any thought? When Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah bring the remnant back to rebuild, the idea of remnant carries with it the idea of what? It's only a small portion of the whole. The rest of those people made the decision to stay in all of these widespread places. They made the decision to stay in Babylon or Assyria or wherever else they'd been scattered to and deported to through the various captivities, the Assyrian and the Babylonian captivity. It was a remnant that came back, a remnant who decided to pursue righteousness that came back. It was a remnant who got it, who listened, who heard, who awoke themselves to the call of God. May we be among their number. And I find it fascinating that God goes on to, again, to use terminology that's spectacular as He talks about this. Look at verse 6. when he talks about this deliverance and this comfort, notice what he says. Lift up your eyes to the heavens and look at the earth beneath. For the heavens will vanish like smoke, the earth will wear out like a garment, and they who dwell in it will die in like manner. But my salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will never be dismayed. He says, when I bring all of this about, when I comfort you, when I deliver you, when you pursue me like I desire you to pursue me, when you finally get it and the change takes place, the change is going to be so dramatic. It's going to be no longer business as usual. The heavens as you know them are going to vanish like smoke. It's going to be the difference between night and day, in other words. The earth will wear out like a garment, and those who insist on living like they've always lived, they're going to die with that earth. But my salvation is forever. What I'm offering you is not going to perish like the earth. It's not going to vanish like smoke, like the heavens. It's not going to be like these people who are going to die in a like manner because of their choice. My salvation will be forever, and my righteousness will never be dismayed. Let me make a suggestion to you. If you often find yourself dismayed, it may be you're trusting in the wrong source of righteousness. Rather than trusting in the righteousness of God and the justice that He holds up as a beacon, as a light, you've got some other form of righteousness or justice that you hitched your wagon to. God says that will lead you to dismay, but my righteousness will never lead you down that path. My righteousness will never be dismayed. If we possess His righteousness, we will not be dismayed. What a contrast. And in the contrast, we find heart. We find courage. We find comfort. He then goes on to talk about those who really know this righteousness. Notice verse 7. Listen to me, you who know righteousness. Those of you who get it, listen to me, the people in whose heart is my law. Pay attention. Don't fear. Don't fear the reproach of man. You see, God doesn't promise us that reproaches won't come. Here He's telling His righteous, the one who knows that the law of God is in his heart, reproach is going to come. He just says, don't fear it. Do not fear the reproach of man, nor be dismayed at their revilings. Revilings are going to come. Who better to illustrate that than Jesus Himself? We'll talk more about that next Sunday morning. He's not talking to that servant now. He's talking to His people, plural. He's talking to the people who make up the nation, the people who get it. And He says, do not lose heart. Do not fear. Do not be dismayed. Comfort is found in this deliverance. You go back to verse 6, you can see that. It's a literal call to arms here. And He's going to tell us a little bit about some things. He reminds them about their past battles. Egypt's help is worthless and empty. Therefore, I have called her Rahab who sits still. I've missed a verse here in chapter 51 in verse 8. For the moth will eat them like a garment, and the worm will eat them like wool, but the righteousness will be forever, and my salvation to all generations. Verse 9. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, generations long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces, who pierced the dragon? If you're just reading Isaiah 51, you may not remember who that Rahab referenced and who that dragon was. Isaiah 30, verse 7, tells us that Rahab here is Egypt. And Ezekiel 29:3 tells us that the dragon is Egypt as well. He's referencing their deliverance. I've already delivered you once. I've delivered you from Egypt. That ought to make a difference. That ought to lend credence to all that I've said to you up to this point in time. If you look at verse 10 of chapter 51, was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made the depths of the sea a way for the redeemed to pass over? So the reference to the crossing of the Red Sea provides for them another reference to the fact that God can and will deliver them. And then in verse 11 of chapter 51, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion. Just as those things happened with respect to Egypt and the passing through the Red Sea and my delivering you then, so shall the ransom of the Lord return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Yeah, have you ever noticed just how often there's this coupling of joy and singing among the people of God? I don't think that's by accident. When we can have the kind of gladness that God provides, when we can possess the kind of joy that Jehovah brings, singing is just a natural response. Sorrow and sighing flee away, but we come singing. And so he goes into verse 12, and he said, I am he who, dot, dot, dot. We're going to look at a series of things relatively quickly here that this one, obviously, I am he who is Yahweh. It's the God of heaven. It's the Holy One, the Redeemer of Israel. He says, I'm the one who comforts. I am he who comforts you. Who are you that you are afraid of man who lies, or dies, excuse me, of the Son of Man who is made like grass? Why are you afraid of men? I'm the one who comforts you. And who are you that you are afraid of a man who dies? So take comfort. Take comfort in the Lord. Don't allow the circumstances that surround you. I think that's a way of saying that the physical that happens to us shouldn't overwhelm us, because we have one above all of that who comforts us. Whatever our circumstance may be, we need to take comfort in the God who says, I've delivered my people over and over and over again. And all of us in this room know that what he says to these people on this occasion, what Isaiah has been saying to these people all along, comes true. We know how the story ends. And so it's not like we're them and we only have Egypt, as though that weren't enough. You'd think that, you know, that was pretty impressive, delivering the people from Pharaoh and through the sea and all that God did for his people then. He used that with these people to help them see what they needed to see. And he's using not only that, but the circumstance with these people that Isaiah is speaking to help us understand that we ought to appreciate the comfort that comes from him, and we ought not to fear man or the circumstances of men. We ought to find our comfort in the Lord. But probably like love, you know, as much some people look for, and what is the old country and western song, where are we looking for it? All the wrong places. And we seek our comfort that way too. God says, I am he who comforts you. But not only does he comfort, he stirs up. I am the Lord your God who stirs up. In this case, I'm going to stir up the sea so that its waves roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. And so I'm going to stir some things up. I'm going to start making a difference. So you need to pay attention. Verse 17, wake up. Wake yourself, wake yourself. Stand up. You're going to participate in this, Israel. You're going to participate in this remnant. Wake yourself up. Shake the sleep out of your eyes. Rub it out. Whatever you got to do. Get ready. I want you to stand up. You who have drunk from the hand of the Lord. You whom I've punished you. I know I've punished you. You've drunk from the hand of the Lord the cup of His wrath. You've drunk to the dregs of the bowl and the cup of staggering. I've punished you for a reason. But now it's time for you to wake up from all of that. And stand up. Note verse 19. These two things have happened to you. And who will console you? Well, He's already answered the second question. He's answered the question He's asked after He said two things will happen to you. I'm going to comfort you. But you face devastation and destruction. You faced famine and sword. Who will comfort you? I will. I've already told you I'm going to be the one who comforts. But you need to stand up and you need to pay attention. You need to get the message. Israel suffered those calamities. But I will comfort you. And not only will He comfort, He'll plead for the cause of His people. Verse 22. Thus says the Lord your God, who pleads the cause of His people. He's on our side. Even in their captivity, that was done for their benefit. Isn't that what we tell our children when we take them and bend them over our lap and spank their bottom? This is for your own good. Whack! This is for your own good. That's what God was doing to His people. This is for their own good. He's pleading their cause. Sometimes it's even with them that He's pleading their own cause. He's trying to get their attention. The Lord, your God, who pleads the cause of His people. Behold, I have taken from your hand that cup of staggering that we just read about. That cup that led to devastation and destruction. I've taken that from your hand, the cup of staggering, the bowl of my wrath. You'll drink it no more. I'm taking it away from you. As a matter of fact, I'm going to give it to Babylon. And I will put it into the hand of your tormentors, who have said to you, bow down that we may pass over. And you have made your back like the ground and like the street for them to pass over. They've walked all over you, taking advantage of you in every way imaginable. Now they're going to drink that cup of devastation and destruction. I'm taking the cup of staggering from you. Those of you who get it are going to come home. I'm going to comfort you, and I'm going to give it to them. And he progresses then into chapter 52 by talking about the strength and beauty that will be theirs. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion. Put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. There's something again about their role in this. They're going to put on the strength. They have to make the choice. They have to make the decision that this is what I'm going to do, or what we're going to do. This is what we're going to be, what we're going to put on. We're going to put on the strength of the Lord. We're going to put on these beautiful garments that the Lord provides. And notice what God says is going to result. For there shall no more come into you the uncircumcised and the unclean. No longer is paganism going to be the problem for the people of God. And historically, once they return, think about it for a moment, idolatry no longer is a real problem for God's people. They have other problems by the time Jesus comes on the scene, but it's not idolatry. It's not paganism as has plagued them since they went into the promised land. God keeps His word to these people, but He says, awake, put on your strength, awake, put on your garments. Look at verse 2, shake yourself. Shake yourself from the dust and arise. Stand up. You are my people. Don't lie down for them anymore. Don't lie down for that kind of stuff anymore. Stand up, shake the dust from yourself, and seat yourself back home. Go back home. Loose the bonds from your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. Take the yoke off. For them, that was the yoke of bondage to Babylon in one sense, in a literal sense. It was the yoke of idolatry, the sin of idolatry in another sense. And for us, it's that burden of sin that we bear. We take it off. We need to do just like they did. Shake that stuff away from us. We need to shake that stuff, arise, and say, no more. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm not going to live like that anymore. I'm not going to make those choices anymore. We need to loose the bonds from our neck. Loose the bonds of captivity. Notice, as God rehearses Israel's alienation. For thus says the Lord, you were sold for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. You ever think about that for a moment. You were sold for nothing, and you shall be redeemed without money. Their return is not going to be the result of some sort of negotiation between God and Babylon. I think that's what he's saying. You went there not because I literally sold you to Babylon. I used them to punish you. And I'm not going to negotiate with them a price to bring you back. When you get it, and when we work this out together between me and you, I'm going to bring you back without money. No one's going to be able to negotiate this deal. No deal between God and Israel's oppressors. Because I'm going to punish them with the same cup that I punished you. We've already noted that. And whether we're talking about Assyria or Babylon, God was not forced to sell them into bondage, and there is no one, regardless of their military might or their worldly perception, who is going to be able to stand against God, the Holy One of Israel, and demand anything from Him. He will do this on His terms. Verse 4, for thus says the Lord God, my people went down at first into Egypt to sojourn there, and the Assyrian oppressed them for nothing. Now therefore, what have I here, declares the Lord, seeing that my people are taken away for nothing? Their rulers wail, declares the Lord, and continually all the day my name is despised. Therefore my people shall not know my name. Therefore in that day they shall know that it is I who speak. Here I am. And then the last six verses, verses 7 through 12, is really a powerful summary of all that's said, not just in chapters 51 and the first part of chapter 52. It's really a good, concise summary of everything going all the way back to chapter 40 and verse 1. Let's look at those verses. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of Him who brings good news, who publishes peace, who brings good news of happiness, who publishes salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. The voice of your watchmen, they lift up their voice. Together they sing for joy, for eye to eye they see the return of the Lord to Zion. Remember, that's been, to a large degree, what he's been talking about ever since chapter 40. Break forth together into singing, you waste places of Jerusalem. For the Lord has comforted His people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord has bared His holy arm before the eyes of all of the nations. And all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. Leaning on the everlasting arms. You ever wonder where that song might have originated from? God bared His holy arm. And as a result, all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God. Depart, depart, go out from there, touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her, purify yourselves, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. For you shall not go out in haste, and you shall not go in flight. For the Lord will go before you, and the God of Israel will be your rear guard. They already had that history with their God. They should have understood immediately the force of that language. And in this picture, as Isaiah often does, he draws his conclusion with this very graphic picture that we've just read. A city under siege looking for deliverance, and that deliverance coming from the God who called them to be His people. And they understood, the ones who got it, understood that if this rescuer doesn't come, there is no hope. If we don't trust in this God who bears His arm so that all can see His salvation, if He doesn't come, we have no hope. Hope is lost. And so the watchman in verse 8 urges them to sing for joy. They've seen the servant from afar who signaled the good news. Verse 7. And God flexes His muscles, if you will. He defeats the oppressor. He redeems His people. And His people returned are free. Free from Babylon. Free from paganism. Free to rebuild the temple of their God. Free to rebuild the city of David. But that message doesn't stop there with them. It continues to us. And we can be free. Jesus talked about our being free indeed. We can be freed by coming to Him. By coming to that one who was the bringer, original bringer of glad tidings. That servant that we're going to look at next Sunday morning. Who suffered so we can be free. Who suffered so we could awake. We could arise. We could shake off the dust. We could loose the shackles of sin. We could take off the yoke of spiritual bondage. And we could pursue righteousness. I want you to think about whether or not you have done those things in your life. Not like those who returned with Zerubbabel and Ezra and Nehemiah. But those who on the day of Pentecost in Acts chapter 2, who came to Christ at the preaching of Peter, who knew they were lost and in their sin, knew they were still shackled by sin, enslaved by an oppressor far more severe than Babylon could ever imagine being. We mentioned in class, and I saw this on Facebook, and somebody else had shared something that they'd seen from somewhere else, but it talked about sin. And how that sin deceives, because it costs more than you want to pay. It takes you where you don't want to go. And it keeps you longer than you want to stay. And there was a fourth that slipped my mind at the moment. But that illustrates the point that Babylon could not keep Israel any longer than God was going to let them keep Israel. Sin is different. God is not going to step in any more than He already has in the offering of His Son to convince you and I to leave sin. You and I are going to have to make up our minds if we're going to wake up, if we're going to awake ourselves and stand up and say, I understand, I get it. I understand what You've done for me. And I want to pursue that. I want to pursue that more than I want this life of passing pleasure, as Hebrew writer refers to it. I want You more than I want anything. I want to lean on that arm of salvation that speaks to salvation to all who will listen. I want to be saved from my sin. If you're subject to the invitation and need that salvation, we urge you to come while we stand and sing.